Ecclesiastes chapter 3 and verse 1 again says, "To everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under the heaven." 2 Timothy 4 verses 1 and 2 says, "I charge thee therefore before God and the Lord Yeshua the Christ, who shall judge the quick and the dead, at his appearing in his kingdom, preach the word, be instant in season and out of season. Reprove, rebuke, exhort with all longsuffering and doctrine." And then 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 15, the third of these three texts that we've used in this series, says, "But sanctify the Lord God in your hearts, and be ready always to give an answer to every man that asketh you of the reason of the hope that is in you, but with meekness and fear." This will be to everything a season, to every season a man, and to every man an answer. This will be part 8. This will be the final message, if I get through it, of this series. An answer for every man is, of course, what we've been concentrating on, and for every, in fact, every type of man. And hopefully it has become abundantly clear, if it wasn't already before this series, that there are indeed different types of men who need to be dealt with in different ways. Thus far, in addition to sheep, we have discussed how, what, and when, at least to some degree, how, what, and when to answer goats, dogs, hogs, and asses. And there are still a few other animal types described in the Bible that also deserve some comment before concluding this series. For example, what about the people that the Bible describes as lions? First, let's discuss, who does the Bible depict as lions? Well, certainly this group, and those who have been on the tape ministry for any length of time, know that in addition to false prophets, I think there's one verse, at least one verse, that describes false prophets, in addition to false prophets, that the Bible principally uses the depiction of lions to describe government and or political rulers. And I would guess that it does so from the fact that lions are both regal and fierce type animals. So, with that in mind, how are we to respond to lions? Or at least those depicted as lions in the Bible, particularly talking about political rulers. Well, like as with an ass or a fool, it all depends on the type of lion. Don't be fooled that all lions merit the same type of response. One type of lion merits one type of response, and other types of lions, or other lions, I should say, deserve another type of response. Let's begin in looking at this by turning to Romans chapter 13. Romans chapter 13 and verse 7 to begin with. Romans chapter 13 and verse 7. It says, "Render therefore," give an answer, and whatever else is necessary or required. But it says, "Render therefore to all their dues, tribute to him, tribute to whom tribute is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, and honor to whom honor." Now the principal point of that verse within the context, the principal point of that verse is that we are to render to people what is their due. And by the way, it doesn't say, be sure you catch this, it doesn't say what they think or demand is their due, or what other men may declare is their due, but instead what they are due according to Yahweh. And that just very well may be even the exact opposite of what they think or demand is their due. By their theology, some people interpret Romans 13:7 in the following fashion. In this fashion, tribute is due, custom is due, fear or reverence is due, honor is due, therefore we are obliged to render tribute, custom, fear, and honor, period. Isn't that the way it's often taught when you really get down to the brass tacks of it? However, with the proper textual emphasis upon Romans 13:7, it should be read in the following fashion. Render therefore to all their dues, tribute to whom tribute is due. Custom to whom custom is due. Fear to whom fear is due. And honor to whom honor is due. In other words, Christians are, now get this, Christians are obliged to render tribute, custom, reverence, and honor to the lions, to whom deserve or merit tribute, custom, reverence, and honor. Now, some people try to take this verse and try to get away from that completely and say that it's really not talking about lions at all here in the sense that we're talking about lions in this message. Don't be fooled by that. I guarantee you we're not going to go into the proving that point, but that is what this passage is talking about. And it is saying that Christians are obliged to render tribute, custom, fear, reverence, or fear and honor to whom they're due, to the lions that are due just that. So, what kind of lions merit such a response? Well, Paul tells us right here in the context of Romans 13:7. Let's jump back up to Romans chapter 13 and verse 1 where it all begins. And actually, it might be better had verse 21 been the beginning of chapter 13, but that's something else for another message. Romans chapter 13 and verse 1, it says the following, "Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God, and the powers that be are ordained of God." Now, what are these higher powers it's talking about? And that's where some people want to try to say that the only higher power is God, so this is only talking about rendering to God what is due Him. Well, it just doesn't fly with the context and what we have with other passages. But what is it talking about? New American Standard, I think, really translates it better when it says, "Let every person be subject to the governing authorities. For there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God." And it goes on in verse 2 to say, "Whosoever therefore resisteth the power or the authority, resisteth the ordinance of God. And they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation." Now, let me ask you this. Again, New American Standard. "Let every person be in subjection to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God." Now, let me ask you this question. Are all authorities, good and bad, ordained or established or determined by God? Good and bad. Well, yes, they certainly are. Keep your finger in Romans chapter 13. Turn to Daniel chapter 4. We may not like that idea. You know, who wants to believe that God ordained Bill Clinton to be our last president? Well, look at Daniel chapter 4 and verse 25. Specifically, we won't need to read the whole verse, but the very last phrase of this long verse, starting with the Most High God. If you're there, look for that phrase at the end of it. And it says, "The Most High God rules in the kingdom of men, and that He appointeth over it whomsoever He will." All right? Even ungodly, wicked rulers? Well, look at verse 17 of this same chapter. Verse 17, where it says, now what did I do here? I was in the wrong chapter, wasn't I? 25. Where did I read that from? Was that 25? I just got the wrong page here. All right, go back to verse 17 now. "Even ungodly men," look what it says. "This dream I..." No, that's not right either. Where am I here? Something's wrong. Daniel 4 and verse 17. Yeah, okay. It says, "This matter is by the decree of the watchers and the demand by the word of the holy ones, to the intent that the living may know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men and giveth it to whomsoever He will." There it is again. "And setteth up over it the basest of men." So, yes, Yahweh determines or ordains all rulers in all kingdoms or all nations, the good, the bad, and yes, even the ugly. And therefore, it's easy to see how much of Christendom has come to the conclusion that Christians are to be subject to governing authorities because they've all been appointed or ordained by God, even if they are wicked, tyrannical antichrist. You can see it. It's easily understood why they'd come to that conclusion. It's very easy to see why they came to that conclusion. They did so by ignoring the context of Romans chapter 13 and the sum of God's word on this issue. Think about this. If modern Christendom's interpretation of Romans chapter 13 verses 1 and 2 is correct, if it's correct, then let's face it. They are more godly and better Christians than were Shiphrah and Puah, the two midwives who helped save Moses' life when he was but an infant. And Moses himself, and David, and Daniel, and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and Gideon, and Rahab, and the prophets, and Peter, John, and Paul, and the other apostles. Right? They're better than Christians and more godly than them. Who all believed that they ought to obey God rather than men. At least, that is, when the two were in conflict with each other. Now, does Paul, in Romans 13, teach obedience to governing authorities? You bet he does. And there's no way around that. You bet he does. The type of authority or lion that he then describes in verses 3 and 4. And that is what so often is missed. It's like in the book Christian Duty Under Corrupt Government, where I did a verse-by-verse commentary, providing first the usual Judeo-Christian interpretation of the verses, and then providing the more accurate interpretation by the context and the rest of the Bible. And when I got to verse 3 and 4, under the heading Usual Interpretation, if you'll remember, under verse 3 I had silence. They don't make any comments. Go read the commentaries. Because of the position they take, they cannot comment on verse 3. And then when I got to verse 4, underneath the usual interpretation, I put more silence. Because once again, they've taken their theology has come from taking the verses that they have centered in on out of the context of verses 3 and 4, which provides us the kind of authorities, the kind of lions that Paul says Christians are obliged to submit to. It does indeed teach obedience to the governing authorities, the type that he describes. Let's go back to Romans chapter 13. And let's now look at verse 3. Verse 3, it says, "For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil." Now wait, let's stop right there before we read the rest of that verse in verse 4. Stop right there. Are there some rulers who cause terror to the righteous rather than to the wicked? Hello? Of course there are. In fact, history demonstrates that there has probably been more of that type of ruler than the type of ruler that Paul is describing in this passage. Was Peter, John, or Paul, and Paul ever persecuted, ever imprisoned, ever beat for their righteousness? Think about Peter and remember Acts chapter 4? What did they do? What was the dastardly deed that John and Peter did that merited the governing authorities coming down upon them and beating them and imprisoning them and saying, "Don't you ever preach again in the name of this man"? What was the dastardly deed? Did they murder someone? Had they stolen from the temple? Had they kicked the dog as it ran by them? No, they had healed a man who was crippled in his legs so that he could walk. Now, either Paul is not talking about those types of rulers, the rulers who would do such dastardly deeds as that history is replete with examples of, or he has completely forgotten his own persecution at the hands of Caesar and other government officials. The guy's a little wacko after all. That's what you have to conclude if you take the usual Judeo-Christian interpretation of Romans chapter 13. Now back to Romans chapter 13 and verse 3 and 4 together now. It says, "For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Will then thou not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise from the same." Verse 4, "For he is the minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid. For he beareth not the sword in vain, for he is a minister of God, a revenger that executeth wrath upon him that doeth evil." You know, it's actually quite clear. Well, you just don't jump over verses 3 and 4, that it's actually quite clear that Paul's not describing every despot, tyrant, or antichrist that has presided, you might want to think about that word, who has presided over men or sat upon a throne in their white houses or their ivory palaces, but only those who can be accurately described as ministers of God. That is, those who minister on behalf of Yahweh. Now, how many rulers today do you know like that? That fit that description. And those who praise or commend Christians and administer and execute Yahweh's judgments upon the wicked. That's the kind of ruler he's talking about. That Christians are indeed obliged to submit to and be in obedience to. The Apostle Paul concurs, by the way. We have a second witness of this very same thing. Turn to 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 13. Look what it says. It says, "Submit yourselves to every ordinance of man." Now, let me stop there. This wasn't in my notes, but think about that. Let's just stop right there. And do you really think that Peter was inspired to write that we are to submit to every ordinance of man? You know, if that's the case, there's something terribly wrong with the picture and what we have here in comparison to what we have in other places of the Word. Yes, he was inspired to write that. We cannot get away from that. But remember, context, context, context. "Submit yourself to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake." Now stop there as well. It says, "for the Lord's sake." Don't miss that. Do you really think submitting to a law that would require you to execute fellow Christians like Paul was once required to do could be described as for the Lord's sake? Or a law that would require you to finance the murder of unborn infants as being for the Lord's sake? Or laws that promote multiculturalism and pluralism in conflict with the first and second commandments as being for the Lord's sake? Do you think that's what? Does anybody in any stretch of the imagination think that those things and so many other laws that man has come up with can be described as for the Lord? Now let's read it, verses 13 in its entirety, along through verse 14. "Submit yourself to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether it be to the king as supreme, or unto governors, as unto them that are sent by him." Who's the him? In this case, it's the higher governor or president or whoever it would be. But then notice how it ends. "For the punishment of evildoers." Now, who determines who's an evildoer or not? Well, I'll tell you, there's a lot of those sitting in their ivory palaces who would like to determine who's an evildoer, but there's only one lawgiver, right? And so only he can determine what's evil and what is not. And it says, "for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of them that do well." Sounds like Paul wrote that, didn't it? It was just God inspiring as a second witness through Peter the same thing. Indeed, do not miss this, Christians are to submit, to obey to such authorities. Such lions, as such regal lions, if you will, as described by Paul and Peter. Because such lions described therein, who praise and do good to the righteous and punish the wicked, are ministers or representatives of Yahweh, and therefore are due tribute, custom, reverence, and honor. But what about those indeed are due that? But what about the rulers or the lions who are or let me back up. What about the rulers who are or who have turned into roaring, ravening, devouring lions or bears or wolves, as they sometimes are also described? What about those kind of leaders? Those kind of leaders aren't even dealt with in those passages. Like those described, for example, in Proverbs 28:15. Now listen carefully to this, because we want to come back to this, at least this first passage, a little bit later on in the message. Like those described in Proverbs 28:15, for example, that says, "Like a roaring lion and a rushing bear is a wicked ruler over a poor people." Proverbs chapter 19 and verse 12 says, "The king's wrath is like the roaring of a lion." And Proverbs chapter 20 and verse 2 says, "The terror of a king is like the growling of a lion." So, what should our answer be to those kinds of rulers or lions? Well, let's begin in answering that question by turning to Ecclesiastes chapter 10. Ecclesiastes chapter 10 and verse 4, reading it to begin with from the King James, it says, "If the spirit of the ruler rise up against thee, leave not thy place, for yielding pacifieth great offenses." Now, you might say, what's that mean? and rightly so. That's good old King James. Let me read it to you in the New American Standard, and you've certainly heard this verse used by me in the past. It'll sound a whole lot familiar now, reading it from the New American Standard. And there it says, if the ruler's temper rises against you, do not abandon your position, for composure allies great offenses. I love that verse in the New American Standard. I don't even understand it in the King James Version. If a ruler's temper rises against you, do not abandon your position, for composure allies great offenses. In other words, if you're standing upon the Word of God, if you've taken a righteous, godly stand, don't back off, even for a roaring, devouring lion, or much less for a media snake. Every year, there are several politicians and preachers and others who back off, apologize, compromise, and make a deal with the devil, if you will, after having taken a righteous and godly stand on some issue of the day. Army Lieutenant General William G. Boykin is the latest double-minded, unprincipled coward to do so. I don't know if you've seen it's certainly been in the news, not here just immediate news, but within the last month or so, in the papers. Newsmax.com, for example, on the Internet, October 19, 2003, had an article entitled, "General Apologizes for Religious Comments." How many times have we seen that heading or something very similar to it? "General apologizes for religious comments." Here's a part of it. In a statement, Army Lieutenant General William G. Boykin said he never meant to offend Muslims. Quote, within a quote, "I'm not anti-Islam or any other religion," end of quote, Boykin said. Quote, I support the free exercise of all religions. For those who have been offended by my statements, I offer a sincere apology," end of quote. It's interesting, too, where they found him. If you remember some of the clips, the preaching that they attacked was in churches. It wasn't in the Pentagon. It wasn't in the public eye, so to speak. It was at churches where he had been asked to speak. Now, by the way, I'm not necessarily in agreement with his theology, but the point can still be made for what we're talking about here. He said again, he said, "I'm not anti-Islam. I want you to understand, I'm not anti-Islam or any other religion." Go back and listen to the message he preached. You know, his enemies can say, "You're a flat-out liar," at least according to what you preached earlier. He said, "I'm not anti-Islam or any other religion." Well, here's for the record. I am anti-Islam, anti-Hinduism, and anti-Judaism. And if you claim to be a follower of Christ, then you had better be anti-all other religions as well. Don't fall for this political correct nonsense that Christians shouldn't be that way. That we're too kind and gentle and we wouldn't dare be against anything. That's what they want us to be. Well, for the record, I'm against all of them. And you had better be too if you claim to be a follower of Christ. Because Yeshua declared that I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no man comes to the Father except through me. That eliminates all the rest of them. You can't do what all the rest of them want to do, is say, we'll let everybody have their religion, Christianity too. No, you allow Christianity in and it throws out everybody else. Furthermore, he also said in John chapter 10 and verses 7 through 10, listen to this very carefully. He said, "Truly, truly, I say unto you, I am the door of the sheep." Now maybe some of the others are the door for the donkeys and the dogs and the hogs and the rest of them. I don't know. But he said, "I am the door of the sheep." And then he said, "All who came before me are thieves and robbers. But the sheep did not hear them. I am the door. If anyone enters through me, he shall be saved and shall go in and out and find pasture. The thief comes in only to steal and kill and destroy." And then in verse 1, he moreover declared the following. He says, "Truly, truly, I say to you, he who does not enter by the door," who was the door? He was the door. "He who does not enter in by the door into the fold of the sheep, but climbs in some other way," like those in those other religions who try at least to, "he is a thief and a robber." Boykin said, "I support the free exercise of all religions," you know, once he was under pressure. Well, let's just call Boykin for what he is. He's a promoter of multicultural pluralism and therefore promotes First and Second Commandment transgressions. In other words, Boykin is a Christian imposter, like regrettably so many are today, who would do the same thing. Boykin also was quoted as saying, quote, "I am neither a zealot nor an extremist," end of quote, the general said in the statement, quote, "only a soldier who has an abiding faith," end of quote. Give me a break. An abiding faith? That's what he calls an abiding faith. He takes a stand, you know, and then he calls it abiding faith when he backs off of it under a little pressure from the media. Once again, it's clear that Boykin is not a Christian. Remember, there's a lot of people who claim to be Christians today who just simply aren't. Just claiming to be a Christian doesn't make you one. Read Matthew 7, 21 through 23 and a lot of other passages. Christ, another passage, Christ said, "Why do you call me Lord, Lord? Why do you claim to be a Christian?" is another way of saying the same thing. "And do not what I say." Or, "Why do you take a stand at one point and you get under a little pressure and all of a sudden you back off of it? Don't call me Lord. Don't call me your Lord if that's what you're going to do." Boykin is not a Christian because let me assure you that you cannot be a Christian unless you're a zealot and an extremist. Christianity and zealots and extremists are synonymous terms. Now give this just a little bit of thought here. I want to see if anybody can come up with it. But how do you think you'd describe someone who claims to be a Christian and who's not a zealot or an extremist? Well, how about lukewarm? Don't you think that's pretty good fence straddler? You know, lukewarm. That's where Boykin's got himself, by the way. He's got himself in a real predicament because he's got one foot in both camps now. And when a man is straddling a fence, that's not a good place to be. But lukewarm is a pretty good description for somebody who's not a zealot and not an extremist. And don't forget, it's the lukewarm whom Yeshua said, "I will spew them out of my mouth." I don't want to be a zealot. I don't want to be an extremist. Well, then let me tell you, you don't want to be a Christian then. Boykin's not a zealot. He's not zealous for Christ, and yet he claims to be a Christian. How can you be a Christian and not be zealous for Christ and for His ways? Well, he certainly proved he's not zealous for Christ when he said that he supports the free exercise of all religions. Also shows he doesn't really consider the salvation of others very important to him. In which, by the way, his statement that he supports the free exercise of all religions, don't miss the fact that that would include those that desire to destroy Christianity, like Islam and Judaism. He supports that free exercise of that. Boykin said he's not an extremist as well. Well, let me tell you that to crucify yourself daily to live for Christ is extreme. No matter what persecution, and especially when it matters not what persecution you may face because of your stand. That's an extreme position. I claim to be an extremist, or at least I hope I will, no matter what comes down the pike. And only those who live for Christ in that fashion can truly claim to be Christian. You know what's probably most amazing about Boykin's waffling, equivocating, and making deals with the enemy, if you will, and retreating under fire, is that this man didn't become a general for no reason. This is the same man who, when facing enemies who could have literally taken his life, he didn't retreat at all. I don't know what his record is, but I would guess that being a lieutenant general, the highest official in the Pentagon today, that he faced those situations where he could have literally lost his life, and he never waffled a bit. He stood like a stone wall, if you will. And yet, when facing the pressure of some media snakes, some snakes on the ground, slithering on the ground, some media snakes, and yes, the displeasure of the presiding lion, displeasure, I should say, if I didn't say that right, he waffled, he swayed, he staggered, and he fell all over himself, retreating without even drawing his gun from his holster, or more precisely in this instance, his sword from his sheath. This. Listen to me, or better yet, listen to Solomon. If a roaring, devouring lion comes after you, hold your position. I'm not talking about lions out there in Central Africa. One of those come after you, I say run. And hope you can outrun the guy behind you. But if the kind of roaring, devouring lions we're talking about come after you, hold your position, because composure allies, listen to this, not only great defenses, but a great offenses. Isn't that what it says? Isn't that what Solomon wrote? Now, might you be devoured? Yeah. You just might be devoured. But listen to me. Better to be devoured by some president, attorney general, or some judge than by the eternal King of Kings and Judge of Judges. Or as Yeshua put it in Matthew chapter 10 and verse 28, he said, "And do not fear those who can kill the body, but are unable to kill the soul." but rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell, or what would have been better translated, Gehenna. Or, who knows, take a stand against the lions like Daniel and others did, and it may not be you who's devoured by the lions and the wolves, but instead your enemies. Now, don't walk away from him and say, Ted Weiland guaranteed that if I took a stand against the lions, against those who want to throw me to the lions, that they'd get devoured. And that doesn't always work that way. But we certainly have biblical precedence that it could happen that way again. But you'll never know unless you take the stand, unless you hold your ground. It may be them and not you. Certainly, eventually, ultimately, they'll be the ones devoured by the lion of the tribe of Judah. Now, why do you suppose Yahweh inspired Solomon to pin those words in Ecclesiastes 10:4? Well, certainly one of the reasons has to be because if you do not hold your ground against roaring lions and hissing snakes, you will do just as did General Boykin and make and promote their gods as your own instead of Yahweh. Listen to me. Do not fear lions anymore, except for the lion of lions. Do not fear lions anymore than we should dogs. I pointed out, the worst thing you can do with a dog is fear him and turn tail and run. He's going to get you in one of the tender spots. And you've got no defense against him in that case, or offense. Same with lions. Don't fear a lion any more than you would a dog. Because whom you fear, here's the primary reason, as I've shared with you many times over the years, whom you fear is whom you will obey. And whom you obey ultimately demonstrates who is your God. Boykin demonstrated who his gods were, and it certainly wasn't Yahweh. Hold your ground. And if you really do fear, as I've pointed out on many occasions as well, if you really do fear, just feign courage. Kind of reminds me of the story of a new school teacher, high school teacher, who had injured his back and had to wear one of those plastic cast around the upper part of his body that was quite thin and was fairly easily disguised under his shirt, and you couldn't really tell that he even wore it. And on the first day of the term, still with the cast under his shirt, he found himself assigned to the toughest students in the school. And so the opening day of school, he confidently walked into that room, opened one of the windows on the wall so that it was wide open, sat down at his desk, busying himself at other things. And suddenly a stiff breeze came through that window and it fluttered his tie in front of the students. And he calmly reached down and grabbed his stapler and stapled the tie to his chest. And he never again had a discipline problem in his class. Now listen to me. Fake it if you must, because your enemies aren't going to know the difference. And composure allies great offenses. And besides, why shouldn't we face even roaring, devouring lions and hissing snakes with confidence and even boldness? Why shouldn't we? I mean, just looking at it from God's perspective, I mean, if we dare do it and raise our height and our faith to the point where we're looking at things through His eyes instead of our eyes. But beyond that, why shouldn't we face them with boldness? After all, aren't we promised in Psalms chapter 91 and verses 13 and 14 the following? That we will tread upon the lion and the cobra, and the young lion and the serpent we will trample down. Now, that may apply to real lions. Serpents. I don't think that's what it's talking about. I think it's talking about those in the Bible, the men in the Bible, who are depicted as lions and snakes that God says you're going to be victorious. You can be victorious now, and if not now, if I have other plans for you, if your persecution is for another purpose, then you'll ultimately still be where you'll trample them underfoot, along with the Son of God. Furthermore, instead of submitting to such lions, lions that are a terror to good works instead of evil works, we are admonished. Not only should we hold our ground, not only should we not fear them, but it goes on beyond that. We are admonished to resist them. The exact opposite of what so much of Christianity is preaching that we're to do to them. They're teaching we've got to submit to them all. Did you know the Bible teaches instead that we're to resist them? Turn to 1 Peter chapter 5. 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8. Verse 8, be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion, walketh about seeking whom he may devour. Oh, wait just a minute here, preacher. I thought this was talking about the devil. It is. It is talking about the devil. That devil Nero. Remember, like a roaring lion and a rushing bear, like a roaring lion and a rushing bear is a wicked, wicked ruler over a poor people. Proverbs chapter 28 and verse 15. It is talking about a devil. And there's a lot of other devils just like him around us today. Don't miss that. And how are we told to respond to such devils or such lions? Verse 8. Again, it says, be sober. It begins by saying, be sober. Be vigilant. The today's English version says, be alert. Be on the watch. Why? Well, according to a lot of Christians' theologies today, so you can be ready to do obeisance, homage to the beast. Be sober, be vigilant. You know, that's Peter saying, be ready, get ready, because, boy, you're going to have an opportunity to bow down to this guy as he's getting ready to devour you. Or so you're at least aware of when you're being devoured. I mean, if you're going to be eaten, you certainly want to know about it, right? Why? Why would Peter write, be sober and be vigilant, or be on the alert and be watchful? Well, so that you'll be prepared to resist when the beast wants to eat you alive. That's what he's saying. Look at verse 9. Now that we understand who verse 8 is talking about, that devil Nero or anyone else that fits the description, he says, whom resist steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same afflictions are accomplished in your brethren that are in the world. Resist is what it says. Strong's defines the word that's translated resist as simply stand against. In fact, King James translates that word many times, withstand. Take a stand against him. That kind of takes us back to Ecclesiastes 10:4, doesn't it? And Strong's continues, stand against, that is oppose. That's what the word means. Resist, not submit to or cower before, but resist, oppose, and withstand. Furthermore, Ephesians 5:11, Paul wrote the following. He said, and do not participate in the unfruitful deeds of darkness, but instead expose them. Now, that's the New American Standard Version. I'm not so sure I don't like the King James better in this case, where it says, and have no fellowship with the unfruitful deeds of darkness, but rather reprove them. And Paul didn't differentiate when he made the statement between goats or dogs or lions. When it comes to exposing or reproving those involved in the unfruitful deeds of darkness, there was no caste system that you can't reprove wicked rulers. And of course, if that had been the case, if that is what Paul was saying, then all of the prophets before him would have been in sin. There was no caste system. He didn't differentiate between the type of animal types out there. Now, according to the law of Yahweh, we are not to personally insult lions. And I'm not so sure that sometimes we don't cross over that line. But at the same time, we're not to go to the other extreme. We are not to personally insult our lions, but we are to expose and reprove their evil deeds. God never intended for the populace to let the lions get away with their evil deeds. I believe with all my heart that that's why the people of Israel were judged rather than David himself when he took the unlawful census. And he had David do it to judge the people because God knew that they would not hold him to account for what he was doing. It was a great lesson that we are not to allow the lions and their evil deeds, the lions to get away with their evil deeds. Our answer, therefore, to regal or godly lions is to submit and obey them as unto Yahweh. And to devouring and or ravening lions or wolves or bears, our response should be, first, do not fear them. Second, hold your ground. Third, resist and oppose them. And fourth, expose and or reprove them and their wicked deeds. That's our position. That's the answer to those types of lions. Now, I need to quickly move on here because I want to cover just something we've covered throughout here, but I want to quickly move on to snakes. What should our response now be to snakes? Lots of snakes around us. Not as many as I think sometimes some people think there are. Everybody becomes a snake. But there's lots of snakes. What should be our response to snakes? Now, a lot of what we've said, that we have already said about goats and dogs and hogs and asses and lions also applies to snakes, and we've discussed snakes throughout this message and some of the previous messages as well as we have discussed those types of animals. However, there is one more passage concerning snakes that I don't want to close this message out with without spending a little time dealing with. In addition to not giving what is holy or casting our pearls to snakes, in addition to not compromising and or fearing snakes, in Matthew 10:16, we are told the following. We're told, "Behold," Christ said, "Behold, I send you forth as sheep into the midst of wolves. Be therefore wise as serpents and harmless as doves." And by the way, the Greek word erikaios, translated harmless, would be better rendered innocent. That's not the portion that I want to deal with here particularly. We've kind of talked about it in the past. But harmless is not as good a translation, I believe, as would be innocent. As in Philippians 2:14-16, New American Standard, it says, "Do all things without grumbling and disputing, that you may prove yourselves to be blameless and innocent," same Greek word, "children of God, above reproach, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you appear as lights in the world, holding fast the word of life." Which has been, if you recall, a recurring theme throughout this series, that is certainly a part of, we need to have an irreproachable life, the way we live. That the answer, our answer to men must be found as much in our life as it is in our words. But back to Matthew 10:16. I want you to also note that we are admonished to be as wise as the serpents. Now, the wisdom of serpents is probably better described as subtle and cunning and crafty. In other words, sheep need to understand that not everyone plays by sheep rules. And sometimes when it can be accomplished without, and this is important, without compromising our morality, that's the innocent part of this verse, when it can be accomplished without compromising our morality, that as sheep we need to understand that when handling or dealing with snakes or wolves or lions, whatever the case may be, that sometimes we need to act like a snake. That is, understand me, again, I'm keen especially on the idea that it's without compromising our own morality, but that is being crafty and cunning like they are. Creative, if you will. Sometimes Christians are the least creative people there are. Sometimes when dealing with snakes, you need to be creative like they are. Or that sometimes the best way to deal with a snake or a wolf or a lion is to play by their rules. Isn't that what Yahshua is telling us? Be as wise as the snakes are wise, of course, without compromising your morality. Now, probably the best way for me to get across what I'm talking about is to provide you with some illustrations. As poor as they may be for what we're literally talking about when it really comes down to having to do with it, hopefully these illustrations will kind of get the point across, or maybe get the juices to flowing at some point in time if ever we need to deal with snakes in this fashion. But first, I'm going to share four of them with you. Let there be peace is the first one. It says, a wise old gentleman retired and purchased a modest home near a junior high school. He spent the first few weeks of his retirement in peace and contentment. Then the new school year began. The very next afternoon, three young boys, full of youthful after-school enthusiasm, came down his street, beating merrily on every trash can they encountered. The crashing percussion continued day after day until finally the wise, or we might put in crafty, old man decided it was time to take some action. The next afternoon, he walked out to meet the young percussionist as they banged their way down the street. Stopping them, he said, "You kids are a lot of fun. I like to see you express your exuberance like that. In fact, I used to do the same thing when I was your age. Will you do me a favor? I'll give you each a dollar if you'll promise to come around every day and do your thing." Well, the kids were elated and continued to do their bang-up job on the trash cans. After a few days, the old-timer greeted the kids again, but this time he had a sad smile on his face. "This recession's really put in a big dent in my income," he told them. "From now on, I'll only be able to pay you 50 cents to beat on those cans." The noisemakers were obviously displeased, but they did accept his offer and continued their afternoon ruckus. A few days later, the wily retiree approached them again as they drummed their way down the street. "Look," he said, "I haven't received my Social Security check yet, and I'm not going to be able to give you any more than 25 cents. Will that be okay?" "Lousy quarter," the drum leader exclaimed. "If you think we're going to waste our time beating these cans around for a quarter, you're nuts." "No way, mister, we quit." And the old man enjoyed peace and serenity for the rest of his days. Pretty good example in that. Here's another one. According to a radio report, a middle school in Oregon, I think this actually happened, was faced with a unique problem. A number of girls were beginning to use lipstick and would put it on in the bathroom. That was fine, but after they put on their lipstick, they would press their lips to the mirrors, leaving dozens of little lip prints. Finally, the principal decided that something had to be done. She called all the girls to the bathroom and met them there with a custodian. She explained that all these lip prints were causing a major problem for the custodian, who had to clean the mirrors every day. To demonstrate how difficult it was to clean the mirrors, she asked the custodian to clean one of the mirrors. He proceeded to take out a long-handled brush, dip it into the nearest toilet, and scrub the mirror. Since then, there have been no lip prints on the mirror. Another one, free parking. I think I've shared this with you before. Before going to Europe on business, a man drove his Rolls Royce to a downtown New York City bank and went in to ask for an immediate loan of $5,000. The loan officer, taken back, requested collateral. "Well, then, here are the keys to my Rolls Royce," the man said. The loan officer promptly had the key driven into the bank's underground parking garage for safekeeping and gave him $5,000. 2 weeks later, the man walked through the bank's doors and asked to settle up his loan and get his car back. "That will be $5,000 in principal and $15.40 in interest," the loan officer said. The man wrote out a check and started to walk away. "Wait, sir," the loan officer said. "While you were gone, I found out you are a multimillionaire. Why in the world would you need to borrow $5,000? The man smiled and he says, "Where else could I park my Rolls Royce in Manhattan for 2 weeks for only $15.40? One more. I think I can squeeze this in here. No, I'll save this for another time. I don't think I have time for it. One called Cheap Cigars. And it really is probably closer to the point than any of the rest of them, but I'll have to save it. Innocent as doves, and as wise or crafty as the serpents. In Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 3, Solomon wrote the following. He said, "A prudent man foreseeth the evil and hideth himself, but the simple pass on and are punished." However, be wise enough, be discerning enough to know that there's times you just don't go looking for trouble. Try to avoid it. However, there are times when it's impossible, when we are forced to have to handle snakes and other creepy crawlers. Well, if you find yourself in that situation, to begin with, do not fear them. That's the first thing. And know that also that Yahweh will provide you with an answer at the time if you'll trust Him and how to deal with such critters. In Matthew 10, I want to read the following verses from where we were. It says, "Behold, I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. Be therefore wise as serpents and harmless or as innocent as doves. But beware of men, for they will deliver you up into councils, and they will scourge you in their synagogues. And you shall be brought before governors and kings for my sake, for a testimony against them and the Gentiles or nations. But when they deliver you up, take no thought, no worry, in other words, how or what you shall speak, for it shall be given you in that same hour what you shall speak. For it is not you that speak, but the Spirit of your Father which speaketh in you. Don't fear them. God will provide the answer for every man. Pray for wisdom, discretion, faith, and courage. And know this too, that ultimately it's the Word of God that is the answer for everyone." Let us understand that's our ultimate tool, our ultimate weapon. It's the Word of God, the sword that cuts and divides asunder as far as the soul and the spirit. Whether they're sheep, whether they're goats, dogs, hogs, asses, lions, bears, or wolves, with, of course, differing results or consequences. It is our ultimate weapon. It is our answer to every man, just as it was for Yahshua when he was tempted in the wilderness. Indeed, to everything there is a season. Therefore, let us seek to be the man or the woman for every season with an appropriate answer for every man and every type of man. Let's go to our Father in prayer. Heavenly Father, we're thankful, Lord, that you've indeed provided us with the answers for every man. And I just pray now, Lord, that you'd help us to desire and to seek to be the men and women for this very hour, this very season that you've put upon us. Bless these messages and help it to equip our people, Lord, to have an answer for every man in every season. We glorify you and we praise you for the answers for your word and for all that you give us. Embolden us, strengthen us, and grant us confidence and give us the answers we need. In your name, to your glory, in Yeshua the Christ. Amen.